The Lovely Bones, Disc 8.
Chapter 17. At 21, Lindsay was many things I would never become. But I barely grieved this list anymore. Still, I roved where she roved. I collected my college diploma and rode on the back of Samuel's bike, clinging on to him with my arms wrapped around his waist, pressing into his back for warmth. Okay, it was Lindsay. I realized that. But in watching her, I found I could get lost more than with anyone else. On the night of their graduation from Temple University, she and Samuel rode his bike back to my parents' house, having promised my father and Grandma Lynn repeatedly that they wouldn't touch the champagne tucked inside the bike's panard until they reached the house. "After all, we're college graduates," Samuel had said. My father was soft in his trust with Samuel. Years had gone by when the boy had done nothing but right by his surviving daughter. But on the ride back from Philadelphia down Route 30, it began to rain. Lightly, at first, small pinpricks flashing into my sister and Samuel at 50 miles per hour. The cool rain hit the hot, dry tar of the road and lifted up smells that had been baked in all day under the hot June sun. Lindsay liked to rest her head between Samuel's shoulder blades and take in the scent of the road and the scrappy shrubs and bushes on either side. She had been remembering how the breeze in the hours before the storm had filled all the white gowns of the graduating seniors as they stood outside Macy Hall. Everyone looked poised, for just a moment, to float away. Finally, 8 miles away from the turnoff that led to our house, the rain grew heavy enough to hurt, and Samuel shouted back to Lindsay that he was going to pull off. They passed into a slightly more overgrown stretch of road, the kind that existed between two commercial areas and that gradually, by accretion, would be eliminated by another strip mall or auto parts store. The bike wobbled but didn't fall on the wet gravel of the shoulder. Samuel used his feet to help brake the bike, then waited, as Hal had taught him, for my sister to get off and step a few feet away before he got off himself. He opened the visor of his helmet to yell to her. "This is no good," he said. "I'm going to roll her under those trees." Lindsay followed behind him, the sound of rain hushed inside her padded helmet. They picked their way through the gravel and mud, stepping over branches and litter that had gathered at the side of the road. The rain seemed to be getting heavier still, and my sister was glad she had changed out of the dress she'd worn to commencement and into the leather pants and jacket that Hal had insisted on getting her, despite her protests that she looked like a pervert. Samuel wheeled the bike into the stand of oaks close to the road, and Lindsay followed. They had gone the week before to get haircuts at the same barber shop on Market Street, and though Lindsay's hair was lighter and finer than Samuel's, the barber had given them identical short, spiky cuts. Within a moment of removing their helmets, their hair caught the large drops that filtered through the trees, and Lindsay's mascara began to bleed. I watched as Samuel used his thumb to wipe the traces from Lindsay's cheek. "Happy graduation," he said in the darkness, and stooped to kiss her. Since their first kiss in our kitchen 2 weeks after my death, I had known that he was, as my sister and I had giggled with our Barbies or while watching Bobby Sherman on TV, her one and only. Samuel had pressed himself into her need, and the cement between the two of them had begun to set immediately. They had gone to Temple together, side by side. He had hated it, and she had pushed him through. She had loved it, and this had allowed him to survive. "Let's try and find the densest part of this underbrush," he said. "What about the bike? Hal will probably have to rescue us when the rain stops." "Shit," Lindsay said. Samuel laughed and grabbed her hand to start walking. The moment they did, they heard the first thunderclap, and Lindsay jumped. He tightened his hold on her. The lightning was in the distance still, and the thunder would grow louder on its heels. She had never felt about it the way I did. It made her jumpy and nervous. She imagined trees split down the middle, and houses on fire and dogs cowering in basements throughout the suburbs. They walked through the underbrush, which was getting soaked despite the trees. Even though it was the middle of the afternoon, it was dark, except for Samuel's safety light. Still, they felt the evidence of people. Their boots crunched down on top of tin cans and pushed up against empty bottles. And then, through the thick weeds and darkness, both of them saw the broken window panes that ran along the top of an old Victorian house. Samuel shut off the safety light immediately. "Do you think there's someone inside?" Lindsay asked.
"It's dark."
"It's spooky." They looked at each other, and my sister said what they both were thinking. "It's dry." They held hands in the heavy rain and ran toward the house as fast as they could, trying not to trip or slide in the increasing mud. As they drew closer, Samuel could make out the steep pitch of the roof and the small wooden crosswork that hung down from the gables. Most of the windows on the bottom floor had been covered over with wood, but the front door swung back and forth on its hinges, banging against the plaster wall on the inside. Though part of him wanted to stand outside in the rain and stare up at the eaves and cornices, he rushed into the house with Lindsay. They stood a few feet inside the doorway, shivering and staring out into the pre-suburban forest that surrounded them. Quickly, I scanned the rooms of the old house. They were alone. No scary monsters lurked in corners. No wandering men had taken root. More and more of these undeveloped patches were disappearing, but they, more than anything, had marked my childhood. We lived in one of the first developments to be built on the converted farmland in the area, a development that became the model and inspiration for what now seemed a limitless number. But my imagination had always rested on the stretch of road that hadn't been filled in with the bright colors of shingles and drain pipes, paved driveways and supersized mailboxes. So too had Samuel's. "Wow," Lindsay said. "How old do you think this is?" Lindsay's voice echoed off the walls as if they stood alone in a church. "Let's explore," said Samuel. The boarded up windows on the first floor made it hard to see anything, but with the help of Samuel's safety light, they could pick out both a fireplace and the chair rail along the walls.
"Look at the floor," Samuel said.
He knelt down, taking her with him.
"Do you see the tongue and groove work? These people had more money than their neighbors."
Lindsay smiled. Just as Hal cared only for the inner workings of motorcycles, Samuel had become obsessed with carpentry. He ran his fingers over the floor and had Lindsay do it too.
"This is a gorgeous old wreck," he said.
"Victorian?" Lindsay asked, making her best guess.
"It blows my mind to say this," Samuel said, "but I think it's Gothic Revival. I noticed cross bracing on the gable trim, so that means it was after 1860.
"Look," said Lindsay. In the center of the floor, someone had once, long ago, set a fire.
"And that is a tragedy," Samuel said.
"Why didn't they use the fireplace? There's one in every room." But Samuel was busy looking up through the hole the fire had burned into the ceiling, trying to make out the patterns of the woodwork along the window frames.
"Let's go upstairs," he said.
"I feel like I'm in a cave," said Lindsay as they climbed the stairs. "It's so quiet in here, you can barely hear the rain." Samuel bounced the soft side of his fist off the plaster as he went.
"You could wall someone into this place."
And suddenly it was one of those awkward moments that they had learned to let pass, and I lived to anticipate. It begged a central question. Where was I? Would I be mentioned, brought up and discussed?
Usually now, the answer was a disappointing no. It was no longer a Susie Fest on Earth. But something about the house and the night, markers like graduations and birthdays, always meant that I was more alive, higher up in the register of thoughts, made Lindsay dwell on me more in that moment than she normally might. Still, she didn't mention it. She remembered the heady feeling she had had in Mr. Harvey's house and that she had often felt since, that I was with her somehow, in her thoughts and limbs, moving with her like a twin. At the top of the stairs, they found the entrance to the room they had stared up at. "I want this house," Samuel said. "What?" "This house needs me. I can feel it." "Maybe you should wait until the sun comes out to decide," she said. "It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen," he said. "Samuel Heckler," my sister said, "fixer of broken things."
"One to talk," he said.
They stood for a moment in silence and smelled the damp air coming through the chimney and flooding the room. Even with the sound of rain, Lindsay still felt hidden away, tucked safely in an outside corner of the world with the one person she loved more than anyone else. She took his hand, and I traveled with them up to the doorway of a small room at the very front. It jutted out over what would be the entrance hall of the floor below and was octagonal in shape. "Orioles," Samuel said. "The windows." He turned to Lindsay. "When they're built out like that, like a tiny room, that's called an oriole." "Do they turn you on?" Lindsay asked, smiling. I left them in the rain and darkness. I wondered if Lindsay noticed that when she and Samuel began to unzip their leathers, the lightning stopped and the rumble in the throat of God, that scary thunder, ceased. In his den, my father reached out to hold the snow globe in his hand. The cold glass against his fingers comforted him, and he shook it to watch the penguin disappear and then slowly be covered by the gently falling snow. Hal had made it back from the graduation ceremonies on his motorcycle, but instead of calming my father, providing some assurance that if one motorcycle could maneuver the storm and deliver its rider safe to his door, another one could too, it seemed to stack the probabilities in the reverse in his mind. He had taken what could be called a painful delight in Lindsay's graduation ceremony. Buckley had sat beside him, dutifully prompting him when to smile and react. He often knew when, but his synapses were never as quick now as normal people's, or at least that was how he explained it to himself. It was like reaction time in the insurance claims he reviewed. There was an average number of seconds for most people between when they saw something coming, another car, a rock rolling down an embankment, and when they reacted. My father's response times were slower than most, as if he moved in a world where a crushing inevitability had robbed him of any hope of accurate perception. Buckley tapped on the half-open door of my father's den. "Come in," he said. "They'll be okay, Dad." At 12, my brother had become serious and considerate. Even if he didn't pay for the food or cook the meals, he managed the house.
"You looked good in your suit, son," my father said.
"Thanks." This mattered to my brother. He had wanted to make my father proud and had taken time with his appearance, even asking Grandma Lynn that morning to help him trim the bangs that fell in his eyes. My brother was in the most awkward stage of adolescence. Not boy, not man. Most days he hid his body in big t-shirts and sloppy jeans, but he had liked wearing the suit that day.
"Hal and Grandma are waiting for us downstairs," he said. "I'll be down in a minute."
Buckley closed the door all the way this time, letting the latch snap into place. That fall, my father had developed the last roll of film that I had kept in my closet in my rolls to hold back box. And now, as he often did when he begged just a minute before dinner, or saw something on TV, or read an article in the paper that made his heart ache, he drew back his desk drawer and gingerly lifted the photos in his hand. He had lectured me repeatedly that what I called my artistic shots were foolhardy, but the best portrait he ever had was one I took of him at an angle so his face filled the 3x3 square when you held it so it was a diamond. I must have been listening to his hints on camera angles and composition when I took the pictures he held now. He had had no idea what order the rolls were in or what they were of when he had them developed. There were an inordinate number of photos of Holiday, and many a shot of my feet or the grass, gray balls of blurs in the air which were birds, and a grainy attempt at a sunset over the pussy willow tree. But at some point I had decided to take portraits of my mother. When he'd picked the roll up at the photo lab, my father sat in the car staring at photos of a woman he felt he barely knew anymore. Since then he had taken these photos out too many times to count, but each time he looked into the face of this woman, he had felt something growing inside him. It took him a long time to realize what it was. Only recently had his wounded synapses allowed him to name it. He had been falling in love all over again. He didn't understand how two people who were married, who saw each other every day, could forget what each other looked like. But if he had had to name what had happened, this was it. And the last two photos in the roll provided the key. He had come home from work. I remember trying to keep my mother's attention as Holiday barked when he heard the car pull into the garage. "He'll come out," I said. "Stay still." And she did. Part of what I loved about photography was the power it gave me over the people on the other side of the camera, even my own parents. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw my father walk through the side door into the yard. He carried his slim briefcase, which, years before, Lindsay and I had heatedly investigated, only to find very little of interest to us. As he set it down, I snapped the last solitary photo of my mother. Already her eyes had begun to seem distracted and anxious, diving under and up into a mask somehow. In the next photo, the mask was almost, but not quite, in place. And the final photo, where my father was leaning slightly down to give her a kiss on the cheek, there it was. "Did I do that to you?" he asked her image as he stared at the pictures of my mother, lined up in a row. "How did that happen?" "The lightning stopped," my sister said. The moisture of the rain on her skin had been replaced by sweat. "I love you," Samuel said.
"I know."
"No, I mean I love you, and I want to marry you, and I want to live in this house."
"What?" "That hideous, hideous college shit is over," Samuel screamed. The small room absorbed his voice, barely bouncing back an echo from its thick walls.
"Not for me, it isn't," my sister said. Samuel got up off the floor, where he had been lying beside my sister, and came to his knees in front of her.
"Marry me."
"Samuel? I'm tired of doing all the right things. Marry me, and I'll make this house gorgeous."
"Who will support us?"
"We will," he said, "somehow." She sat up and then joined him, kneeling. They were both half-dressed and growing colder as their heat began to dissipate.
"Okay."
"Okay? I think I can," my sister said, I mean, yes. Some cliches I understood only when they came into my heaven full speed. I had never seen a chicken with its head cut off. It had never meant much to me except something else that had been treated much the same as me. But that moment I ran around my heaven like a chicken with its head cut off. I was so happy I screamed over and over and over again. My sister, my Samuel, my dream. She was crying, and he held her in his arms, rocking her against him. "Are you happy, sweetheart?" he asked. She nodded against his bare chest. "Yes," she said, then froze. "My dad." She raised her head and looked at Samuel. "I know he's worried." "Yes," he said, trying to switch gears with her. "How many miles is it to the house from here?"
10, maybe," Samuel said. "Maybe 8.
"We could do that," she said.
"You're nuts.
We have sneakers in the other Pennard." They couldn't run in leather, so they wore their underwear and t-shirts, as close to streakers as anyone in my family would ever be. Samuel, as he had for years, set a pace just ahead of my sister to keep her going. There were hardly any cars on the road, but when one passed by, a wall of water would come up from the puddles near the side of the road and make the two of them gasp to get air back in their lungs. Both of them had run in rain before, but never rain this heavy. They made a game of who could gain the most shelter as they ran the miles, waltzing in and out to gain cover under any overhanging trees, even as the dirt and grime of the road covered their legs. But by 3, they were silent, pushing their feet forward in a natural rhythm they had both known for years, focusing on the sound of their own breath and the sound of their wet shoes hitting the pavement. At some point, as she splashed through a large puddle, no longer trying to avoid them, she thought of the local pool, of which we had been members until my death brought the comfortably public existence of my family to a close. It had been somewhere along this road, but she didn't lift her head to find the familiar chain-link fence. Instead, she had a memory. She and I were underwater in our bathing suits with their small ruffled skirts. Both of our eyes were open underwater, a new skill, newer for her, and we were looking at each other, our separate bodies suspended underwater. Hair floating, small skirts floating, our cheeks bulging with captured air. Then, together, we would grab onto each other and shoot up out of the water, breaking the surface. We sucked air into our lungs, ears popping, and laughed together. I watched my beautiful sister running, her lungs and legs pumping, and the skill from the pool still there. Fighting to see through the rain, fighting to keep her legs lifting at the pace set by Samuel. And I knew she wasn't running away from me or toward me. Like someone who has survived a gut shot, the wound had been closing, closing, braiding into a scar for 8 long years. By the time the two of them were within 1 mile of my house, the rain had lightened and people were beginning to look out their windows toward the street. Samuel slowed his pace and she joined him. Their t-shirts were locked onto their bodies like paste. Lindsay had fought off a cramp in her side, but as the cramp lifted, she ran with Samuel full out. Suddenly she was covered in goosebumps and smiling ear to ear. "We're getting married," she said. And he stopped short, grabbed her up in his arms, and they were still kissing when a car passed them on the road, the driver honking his horn. When the doorbell rang at our house, it was 4:00, and Hal was in the kitchen wearing one of my mother's old white chef's aprons and cutting brownies for Grandma Lynn. He liked being put to work, feeling useful, and my grandmother liked to use him. They were a simpatico team. While Buckley, the boy guard, loved to eat. "I'll get it," my father said. He had been propping himself up during the rain with highballs, mixed, not measured, by Grandma Lynn. He was spry now, with a thin sort of grace, like a retired ballet dancer who favored one leg over the other after long years of one-footed leaps. "I was so worried," he said when he opened the door. Lindsay was holding her arms over her chest, and even my father had to laugh while he looked away and hurriedly got the extra blankets kept in the front closet. Samuel draped one around Lindsay first, as my father covered Samuel's shoulders as best he could, and puddles collected on the flagstone floor. Just as Lindsay had covered herself up, Buckley and Hal and Grandma Lynn came forward into the hallway. "Buckley," Grandma Lynn said, "go get some towels." "Did you manage the bike in this?" Hal asked, incredulous. "No, we ran," Samuel said. "You what?" "Get into the family room," my father said. "We'll set a fire going." While the two of them sat with their backs to the fire, shivering at first and drinking the brandy shots Grandma Lynn had Buckley serve them on a silver tray, everyone heard the story of the bike and the house and the octagonal room with windows that had made Samuel euphoric.
"And the bike's okay?" Hal asked.
"We did the best we could," Samuel said, "but we'll need a tow."
"I'm just happy that the two of you are safe," my father said. "We ran home for you, Mr. Salmon."
My grandmother and brother had taken seats at the far end of the room, away from the fire. "We didn't want anyone to worry," Lindsay said.
"Lindsay didn't want you to worry, specifically."
The room was silent for a moment. What Samuel had said was true, of course, but it also pointed too clearly to a certain fact, that Lindsay and Buckley had come to live their lives in direct proportion to what effect it would have on a fragile father. Grandma Lynn caught my sister's eye and winked.
"Hal and Buckley and I made brownies," she said, "and I have some frozen lasagna I can break out if you'd like."
She stood, and so did my brother, ready to help.
"I'd love some brownies, Lynn," Samuel said. "Lynn? I like that," she said. "Are you going to start calling Jack, Jack?"
"Maybe." Once Buckley and Grandma Lynn had left the room, Hal felt a new nervousness in the air.
"I think I'll pitch in," he said.
Lindsay, Samuel, and my father listened to the busy noises of the kitchen. They could all hear the clock ticking in the corner, the one my mother had called our rustic colonial clock.
"I know I worry too much," my father said.
"That's not what Samuel meant," Lindsay said. Samuel was quiet, and I was watching him.
"Mr. Salmon," he finally said. He wasn't quite ready to try Jack.
"I've asked Lindsay to marry me." Lindsay's heart was in her throat, but she wasn't looking at Samuel. She was looking at my father. Buckley came in with a plate of brownies, and Hal followed him with champagne glasses hanging from his fingers and a bottle of 1978 Dom Perignon.
"From your grandmother on your graduation day," Hal said.
Grandma Lynn came through next, empty-handed except for her highball. It caught the light and glittered like a jar of icy diamonds. For Lindsay, it was as if no one but herself and my father were there. "What do you say, Dad?" she asked.
"I'd say," he managed, standing up to shake Samuel's hand, "that I couldn't wish for a better son-in-law."
Grandma Lynn exploded on the final word.
"My God! Oh, honey! Congratulations!"
Even Buckley let loose, slipping out of the knot that usually held him and into a rare joy. But I saw the fine wavering line that still tied my sister to my father, the invisible cord that can kill. The champagne cork popped, Like a master, my grandmother said to Hal, who was pouring. It was Buckley, as my father and sister joined the group and listened to Grandma Lynn's countless toasts, who saw me. He saw me standing under the rustic colonial clock and stared. He was drinking champagne. There were strings coming out from all around me, reaching out, waving in the air. Someone passed him a brownie. He held it in his hands, but didn't eat. He saw my shape and face, which hadn't changed. The hair still parted down the middle, the chest still flat and hips undeveloped, and wanted to call out my name. It was only a moment, and then I was gone. Over the years, when I grew tired of watching, I often sat in the back of the trains that went in and out of Suburban Station in Philadelphia. Passengers would get on and off as I listened to their conversations mix with the sound of the train doors opening and closing, the conductors yelling their stops, and the shuffle and staccato of shoe soles and high heels going from pavement to metal to the soft thump-thump on the carpeted train aisles. It was what Lindsay, in her workouts, called an active rest. My muscles were still engaged, but my focus relaxed. I listened to the sounds and felt the train's movement, and sometimes, by doing this, I could hear the voices of those who no longer lived on Earth. Voices of others like me. The Watchers. Almost everyone in heaven has someone on Earth they watch. A loved one, a friend, or even a stranger who was once kind, who offered warm food or a bright smile when one of us had needed it. And when I wasn't watching, I could hear the others talking to those they loved on Earth, just as fruitlessly as me, I'm afraid. A one-sided cajoling and coaching of the young, a one-way loving and desiring of their mates, a single-sided card that could never be signed. The train would be still or stop starting from 30th Street to near Overbrook, and I could hear them say names and sentences. Now be careful with that glass. Mind your father. Oh, look how big she looks in that dress. I'm with you, mother. Esmeralda, Sally, Lupe, Keisha, Frank. So many names. And then the train would gain speed, and as it did, the volume of all these unheard phrases coming from heaven would grow louder and louder. At its height between stations, the noise of our longing became so deafening that I had to open my eyes. I saw women hanging or collecting wash as I peered from the windows of the suddenly silent trains. They stooped over baskets and then spread white or yellow or pink sheets along the line. I counted men's underwear and boys' underwear and the familiar lollipop cotton of little girls' drawers. And the sound of it that I craved and missed, the sound of life, replaced the endless calling of names. Wet laundry. The snap, the yank, the wet heaviness of double and queen-sized sheets. The real sounds bringing back the remembered sounds of the past, when I had lain under the dripping clothes to catch water on my tongue, or run in between them as if they were traffic cones through which I chased Lindsay or was chased by Lindsay back and forth. And this would be joined by the memory of our mother attempting to lecture us about the peanut butter from our hands getting on the good sheets, or the sticky lemon candy patches she had found on our father's shirts. In this way, the sight and smell of the real, of the imagined, and of the remembered all came together for me. After I turned away from Earth that day, I rode the trains until I could think of only one thing. Hold still, my father would say, while I held the ship in the bottle and he burned away the strings he'd raised the mast with and set the clipper ship free on its blue putty sea. And I would wait for him, recognizing the tension of that moment when the world in the bottle depended solely on me. Chapter 18. When her father mentioned the sinkhole on the phone, Ruth was in the walk-in closet that she rented on First Avenue. She twirled the phone's long black cord around her wrist and arm and gave short, clipped answers of acknowledgement. The old woman that rented her the closet liked to listen in, so Ruth tried not to talk much on the phone. Later, from the street, she would call home collect and plan a visit. She had known she would make a pilgrimage to see it before the developers closed it up. Her fascination with places like the sinkhole was a secret she kept, as was my murder and our meeting in the faculty parking lot. They were all things she wouldn't give away in New York, where she watched others tell their drunken bar stories, prostituting their families and their traumas for popularity and booze. These things, she felt, weren't to be passed around like disingenuous party favors. She kept an honor code with her journals and her poems. "Inside, inside," she would whisper quietly to herself when she felt the urge to tell, and she would end up taking long walks through the city, seeing instead the Stolfa's cornfield or an image of her father staring at his pieces of rescued antique molding. New York provided a perfect background for her thoughts. Despite her willed stomping and pitching in its streets and byways, the city itself had very little to do with her interior life. She no longer looked haunted, as she had in high school. But still, if you looked closely at her eyes, you could see the skittery rabbit energy that often made people nervous. She had an expression of someone who was constantly on the lookout for something or someone that hadn't yet arrived. Her whole body seemed to slant forward in inquiry, and though she had been told at the bar where she worked that she had beautiful hair or beautiful hands, or on the rare occasions when any of her patrons saw her come out from behind the bar, beautiful legs, people never said anything about her eyes. She dressed hurriedly in black tights, a short black skirt, black boots, and a black t-shirt, all of them stained from serving double duty as work clothes and real clothes. The stains could be seen only in the sunlight, so Ruth was never really aware of them until later, when she would stop at an outdoor cafe for a cup of coffee and look down at her skirt and see the dark traces of spilled vodka or whiskey. The alcohol had the effect of making the black cloth blacker. This amused her. She had noted in her journal, "Booze affects material as it does people." Once outside the apartment, on her way for a cup of coffee on First Avenue, she made up secret conversations with the bloated lapdogs, Chihuahuas, and Pomeranians that the Ukrainian women held on their laps as they sat on their stoops. Ruth liked the antagonistic little dogs, who barked ardently as she passed. Then she walked, walked flat out, walked with an ache coming up through the earth and into the heel of her striking foot. No one said hello to her except creeps, and she made a game of how many streets she could navigate without having to stop for traffic. She wouldn't slow down for another person and would vivisect crowds of NYU students or old women with their laundry carts, creating a wind on either side of her. She liked to imagine that when she passed, the world looked after her. But she also knew how anonymous she was. Except when she was at work, no one knew where she was at any time of day, and no one waited for her. It was an immaculate anonymity. She wouldn't know that Samuel had proposed to my sister, and unless it trickled down to her through Ray, the sole person she had kept in touch with from school, she would never find out. While still at Fairfax, she had heard my mother had left. A fresh ripple of whispers had gone through the high school, and Ruth had watched my sister cope with them as best she could. Occasionally, the two of them would meet up in the hallway. Ruth would say a few words of support if she could manage them without doing what she thought of as harming Lindsay by talking to her. Ruth knew her status as a freak at school, and knew that their one night at the gifted symposium had been exactly what it felt like. A dream. Where elements let loose came together unbidden outside the damning rules of school. But Ray was different. Their kisses and early pushing and rubbings were objects under glass to her, memories that she kept preserved. She saw him every time she visited her parents and had known immediately that it would be Ray she took when she went back to see the sinkhole. He would be happy for the vacation from his constant studying grind, and if she was lucky, he would describe, as he often did, a medical procedure that he had observed. Ray's way of describing such things made her feel as if she knew exactly what it felt like, not just what it looked like. He could evoke everything for her, with small verbal pulse points of which he was completely unaware. Heading north on first, she could tick off all the places she'd formerly stopped and stood, certain that she had found a spot where a woman or a girl had been killed. She tried to list them in her journal at the end of each day, but often she was so consumed with what she thought might have happened in this or that dark overhang or tight alleyway that she neglected the simpler, more obvious ones, where she had read about a death in the paper and visited what had been a woman's grave. She was unaware that she was somewhat of a celebrity up in heaven. I had told people about her, what she did, how she observed moments of silence up and down the city and wrote small individual prayers in her journal, and the story had traveled so quickly that women lined up to know if she had found where they'd been killed. She had fans in heaven, even though she would have been disappointed to know that often these fans, when they gathered, resembled more a bunch of teenagers poring over an issue of Teen Beat than Ruth's image of low, dirge-like whisperings set to a celestial timpani. I was the one who got to follow and watch, and as opposed to the giddy choir, I often found these moments as painful as they were amazing. Ruth would get an image and it would burn into her memory. Sometimes they were only bright flashes, a fall down the stairs, a scream, a shove, the tightening of hands around a neck. And at other times, it was as if an entire scenario spun out in her head in just the amount of time that it took the girl or woman to die. No one in the street thought anything of the downtown girl dressed in black who had paused in the middle of midtown foot traffic. In her art student camouflage, she could walk the entire length of Manhattan and, if not blend in, be classified and therefore ignored. Meanwhile, for us, she was doing important work, work that most people on Earth were too frightened even to contemplate. The day after Lindsay and Samuel's graduation, I joined her on her walk. By the time she got up to Central Park, it was well past lunchtime, but the park was still busy. Couples sat on the clipped grass of the sheep meadow. Ruth peered at them. Her ardentness was off-putting on a sunny afternoon, and when the open faces of young men caught sight of her, they closed down or looked away. She zigzagged up and across the park. There were obvious places where she could go, like the Rambles, to document the history of violence there without even leaving the trees. But she preferred those places people considered safe. The cool, shimmering surface of the duck pond tucked into the busy southeast corner of the park, or the placid man-made lake where old men sailed beautiful hand-carved boats. She sat on a bench on a path leading to the Central Park Zoo and looked out across the gravel at children with their nannies and lone adults reading books in various patches of shade or sun. She was tired from the walk uptown, but still she took her journal out from her bag. She placed it open on her lap, holding the pen as her thinking prop. It was better to look like you were doing something when you stared into the distance, Ruth had learned. Otherwise, it was likely that strange men would come over and try to talk to you. Her journal was her closest and most important relationship. It held everything. Across from her, a little girl had strayed from the blanket where her nanny slept. She was making her way for the bushes that lined a small rise before giving way to a fence separating the park from Fifth Avenue. Just as Ruth was about to enter the world of human beings whose lives impinged on one another by calling out to the nanny, a thin cord, which Ruth hadn't seen, warned the nanny to wake.
She immediately sat bolt upright and barked an order at the little girl to return. In moments like this, she thought of all the little girls who grew into adulthood and old age as a sort of cipher alphabet for all of those who didn't. Their lives would somehow be inextricably attached to all the girls who had been killed. It was then, as the nanny packed up her bag and rolled up the blanket, preparing for whatever came next in their day, that Ruth saw her. A little girl who had strayed for the bushes one day and disappeared. She could tell by the clothes that it had happened some time ago, but that was all. There was nothing else. No nanny or mother, no idea of night or day, only a little girl gone. I stayed with Ruth. Her journal open, she wrote it down. Time? Little girl in CP strays toward bushes. White lace collar. Fancy. She closed the journal and tucked it into her bag. Close at hand was a place that soothed her. The Penguin House at the zoo. We spent the afternoon together there, Ruth sitting on the carpeted seat that ran the length of the exhibit, her black clothes making only her face and hands visible in the room. The penguins tottered and clucked and dived, slipping off the habitat rocks like amiable hams, but living underwater like tuxedoed mussels. Children shouted and screamed and pressed their faces against the glass. Ruth counted the living just as much as she counted the dead. And in the close confines of the Penguin House, the joyous screams of the children echoed off the walls with such vibrancy that, for a little while, she could drown out the other kinds of screams. That weekend, my brother woke early, as he always did. He was in the 7th grade and bought his lunch at school and was on the debate team, and, like Ruth had been, was always picked either last or second to last in gym. He hadn't taken to athletics, as Lindsay had. He practiced instead what Grandma Lynn called his air of dignification. His favorite teacher wasn't really a teacher at all, but the school librarian, a tall, frail woman with wiry hair who drank tea from her thermos and talked about having lived in England when she was young. After this, he had affected an English accent for a few months and shown a heightened interest when my sister watched Masterpiece Theater. When he had asked my father that year if he could reclaim the garden my mother had once kept, my father had said, "Sure, Buck, go crazy." And he had. He had gone extraordinarily, insanely crazy, reading old burpee catalogs at night when he was unable to sleep, and scanning the few books on gardening that the school library kept. Where my grandmother had suggested respectful rows of parsley and basil, and Hal had suggested some plants that really matter, eggplants, cantaloupes, cucumbers, carrots, and beans, my brother had thought they were both right. He didn't like what he read in books. He saw no reason to keep flowers separated from tomatoes and herbs segregated in a corner. He had slowly planted the whole garden with a spade, daily begging my father to bring him seeds and taking trips to the grocery with Grandma Lynn, where the price of his extreme helpfulness in fetching things would be a quick stop at the greenhouse for a small flowering plant. He was now awaiting his tomatoes, his blue daisies, his petunias and pansies and salvias of all kinds. He had made his fort a sort of work shed for the garden, where he kept his tools and supplies. But my grandmother was preparing for the moment when he realized that they couldn't grow all together, and that some seeds wouldn't come up at certain times, that the fine, downy tendrils of cucumber might be abruptly stopped by the thickening underground bosses of carrot and potato, that the parsley might be camouflaged by the more recalcitrant weeds, and bugs that hopped about could blight the tender flowers. But she was waiting patiently. She no longer believed in talk. It never rescued anything. At 70, she had come to believe in time alone. Buckley was hauling up a box of clothes from the basement and into the kitchen when my father came down for his coffee.
"What you got there, Farmer Buck?"
my father said. He had always been at his best in the morning.
"I'm making stakes for my tomato plants,"
my brother said.
"Are they even above ground yet?"
My father stood in the kitchen in his blue terry cloth robe and bare feet. He poured his coffee from the coffee maker that Grandma Lynn set up each morning and sipped at it as he looked at his son.
"I just saw them this morning," my brother said, beaming. "They curl up like a hand unfolding."
It wasn't until my father was repeating this description to Grandma Lynn as he stood at the counter that he saw, through the back window, what Buckley had taken from the box. They were my clothes. My clothes, which Lindsay had picked through for anything she might save. My clothes, which my grandmother, when she had moved into my room, had quietly boxed while my father was at work. She had put them down in the basement with a small label that said, simply, "Save." My father put down his coffee. He walked out through the screened-in porch and strode forward, calling Buckley's name.
"What is it, Dad?"
He was alert to my father's tone.
"Those clothes are Susie's," my father said calmly when he reached him.
Buckley looked down at my black watch dress that he held in his hand. My father stepped closer, took the dress from my brother, and then, without speaking, he gathered the rest of my clothes, which Buckley had piled on the lawn. As he turned in silence toward the house, hardly breathing, clutching my clothes to him, it sparked. I was the only one to see the colors. Just near Buckley's ears and on the tips of his cheeks and chin, he was a little orange, somehow, a little red.
"Why can't I use them?"
he asked. It landed in my father's back like a fist.
"Why can't I use those clothes to stake my tomatoes?"
My father turned around. He saw his son standing there. Behind him, the perfect plot of muddy, churned-up earth spotted with tiny seedlings.
"How can you ask me that question?"
"You have to choose. It's not fair," my brother said.
"Buck?"
My father held my clothes against his chest. I watched Buckley flare and light. Behind him was the sun of the goldenrod hedge, twice as tall as it had been at my death.
"I'm tired of it," Buckley blared. "Keisha's dad died, and she's okay."
"Is Keisha a girl at school?"
"Yes."
My father was frozen. He could feel the dew that had gathered on his bare ankles and feet, could feel the ground underneath him, cold and moist and stirring with possibility.
"I'm sorry. When did this happen?"
"That's not the point, Dad. You don't get it."
Buckley turned around on his heel and started stomping the tender tomato shoots with his foot.
"Buck, stop!"
my father cried. My brother turned.
"You don't get it, Dad," he said.
"I'm sorry," my father said. "These are Susie's clothes, and I just... It may not make sense, but they're hers. Something she wore."
"You took the shoe, didn't you?"
my brother said. He had stopped crying now.
"What?"
"You took the shoe. You took it from my room."
"Buckley, I don't know what you're talking about."
"I saved the Monopoly shoe, and then it was gone. You took it. You act like she was yours only."
"Tell me what you want to say. What's this about your friend Keisha's dad?"
"Put the clothes down."
My father laid them gently on the ground.
"It isn't about Keisha's dad."
"Tell me what it is about."
My father was now all immediacy.
He went back to the place he had been after his knee surgery, coming up out of the druggy sleep of painkillers to see his then 5-year-old son sitting near him, waiting for his eyes to flicker open so he could say, "Peekaboo, Daddy." "She's dead." It never ceased to hurt.
"I know that."
"But you don't act that way. Keisha's dad died when she was 6. Keisha said she barely even thinks of him."
"She will," my father said.
"But what about us?"
"Who?"
"Us, Dad. Me and Lindsay. Mom left because she couldn't take it."
"Calm down, Buck," my father said.
He was being as generous as he could as the air from his lungs evaporated out into his chest. Then a little voice in him said,
"Let go, let go, let go."
"What?" my father said. "I didn't say anything. Let go, let go, let go."
"I'm sorry," my father said. "I'm not feeling very well."
His feet had grown unbelievably cold in the damp grass. His chest felt hollow, bugs flying around an excavated cavity. There was an echo in there, and it drummed up into his ears.
"Let go."
My father dropped down to his knees. His arm began to tingle on and off as if it had fallen asleep, pins and needles up and down. My brother rushed to him. "Dad?"
"Son?"
There was a quaver in his voice and a grasping outward toward my brother. "I'll get Grandma." And Buckley ran. My father whispered faintly as he lay on his side with his face twisted in the direction of my old clothes.
"You can never choose. I've loved all 3 of you."
That night, my father lay in a hospital bed, attached to monitors that beeped and hummed. Time to circle around my father's feet and along his spine. Time to hush and usher him. But where? Above his bed, the clock ticked off the minutes, and I thought of the game Lindsay and I had played in the yard together. "He loves me, he loves me not," picked out on a daisy's petals. I could hear the clock casting my own 2 greatest wishes back to me in this same rhythm. "Die for me, don't die for me. Die for me, don't die for me." I couldn't help myself, it seemed, as I tore at his weakening heart. If he died, I would have him forever. Was this so wrong to want? At home, Buckley lay in bed in the dark and pulled the sheet up to his chin. He hadn't been allowed past the emergency room where Lindsay had driven them, following the shrieking ambulance inside which lay our father. My brother had felt a huge burden of guilt descend in the silences from Lindsay, in her 2 repeated questions. "What were you talking about? Why was he so upset?" My little brother's greatest fear was that the one person who meant so much to him would go away. He loved Lindsay and Grandma Lynn and Samuel and Hal, but my father kept him stepping lightly, son gingerly monitoring father every morning and every evening as if, without such vigilance, he would lose him. We stood, the dead child and the living, on either side of my father, both wanting the same thing. To have him to ourselves forever. To please us both was an impossibility. My father had only missed night times 2 in Buckley's life. Once after he had gone into the cornfield at night looking for Mr. Harvey, and now as he lay in the hospital and they monitored him in case of a 2nd heart attack. Buckley knew he should be too old for it to matter, but I sympathized with him. The goodnight kiss was something at which my father excelled. As my father stood at the end of the bed after closing the Venetian blinds and running his hands down them to make sure that they were all down at the same slant, no rebel Venetians stuck to let the sunlight in on his son before he came to wake him, my brother would often get goosebumps on his arms and legs. The anticipation was so sweet.
"Ready, Buck?"
my father would say. And sometimes Buckley said, "Roger." Or sometimes he said, "Take off." But when he was most frightened and giddy and waiting for peace, he just said, "Yes." And my father would take the thin cotton top sheet and bunch it up in his hands while being careful to keep the two corners between his thumb and forefinger. Then he would snap it out so the pale blue, if they were using Buckley's, or lavender, if they were using mine, sheet, would spread out like a parachute above him, and gently, what felt wonderfully slowly, it would waft down and touch along his exposed skin, his knees, his forearms, his cheeks and chin. Both air and cover somehow there in the same space at the same time. It felt like the ultimate freedom and protection. It was lovely. Left him vulnerable and quivering on some edge, and all he could hope was that if he begged him, my father would oblige and do it again. Air and cover. Air and cover. Sustaining the unspoken connection between them. Little boy, wounded man. That night, his head lay on the pillow while his body was curled in the fetal position. He hadn't thought to close the blinds himself, and the lights from the nearby houses spotted the hill. He stared across his room at the louvered doors of his closet, out of which he had once imagined evil witches would escape to join the dragons beneath his bed. He no longer feared these things.
"Please don't let Daddy die, Susie," he whispered. "I need him."
When I left my brother, I walked out past the gazebo and under the lights hanging down like berries, and I saw the brick paths branching out as I advanced. I walked until the bricks turned to flat stones and then to small, sharp rocks and then to nothing but churned earth for miles and miles around me. I stood there. I had been in heaven long enough to know that something would be revealed. And as the light began to fade and the sky turn a dark, sweet blue as it had on the night of my death, I saw someone walking into view. So far away I couldn't at first make out if it was a man or woman, child or adult. But as moonlight reached this figure, I could make out a man. And frightened now, my breathing shallow, I raced just far enough to see. Was it my father? Was it what I had wanted all this time so desperately?
"Susie,"
the man said as I approached, and then stopped a few feet from where he stood. He raised his arms up toward me.
"Remember?"
he said. I found myself small again, age 6, and in a living room in Illinois. Now, as I had done then, I placed my feet on top of his feet. "Granddaddy," I said. And because we were all alone and both in heaven, I was light enough to move as I had moved when I was 6 and he was 56 and my father had taken us to visit. We danced so slowly to a song that on earth had always made my grandfather cry.
"Do you remember?"
he asked.
"Barber. Adagio for strings," he said.
But as we danced and spun, none of the herky-jerky awkwardness of earth, what I remembered was how I'd found him crying to this music and asked him why.
"Sometimes you cry, Susie, even when someone you love has been gone a long time."
He had held me against him then, just briefly. And then I had run outside to play again with Lindsay in what seemed like my grandfather's huge backyard.
We didn't speak anymore that night, but we danced for hours in that timeless blue light. I knew as we danced that something was happening on Earth and in heaven. A shifting. The sort of slow to sudden movement that we'd read about in science class one year. Seismic. Impossible. A rending and tearing of time and space. I pressed myself into my grandfather's chest and smelled the old man's smell of him, the mothball version of my own father, the blood on earth, the sky in heaven, the kumquat, skunk, grade A tobacco. When the music stopped, it could have been forever since we'd begun. My grandfather took a step back, and the light grew yellow at his back.
"I'm going," he said.
"Where?" I asked.
"Don't worry, sweetheart. You're so close."
He turned and walked away, disappearing rapidly into spots and dust. Infinity.
This ends Disc 8.